Well, good evening, everybody, and welcome. And thank you for taking time out of a busy ASCO to attend our Data and Perspectives. Clinical investigators discuss the current and future clinical care of patients with HER2-positive gastrointestinal cancers. I'm Dr. Christopher Liu from the University of Colorado, and I'll be moderating the meeting for this evening. This is our outstanding faculty that we've collected to talk about HER2 GI cancers. So as you go from left to right, we have Dr. Sarah Lenardi, Director of the Oncology Unit at Veneto Institute of Oncology. We have Dr. Haley Ellis from the Massachusetts General Hospital, and we have Dr. Kanwal Raga from University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. These are the relevant faculty conflicts of interest. And these are Dr. Love's disclosures. And here's the commercial support for today, Research to Practice CME Planning Committee. Staff and reviewers have no conflicts of interest to disclose. So this program will contain the discussion of non-approved uses of agents and regimens. So as always, please refer to the official prescribing information for each product for the approved indications. All right, so this is our agenda for the next hour and a half. We are actually going to go logically through the GI tract. So we're going to start with gastroesophageal cancers. We'll take a stop at biliary tract cancers, and then we'll wrap up with colorectal cancer. So Dr. Lenardi will present gastroesophageal cancers. Dr. Ellis will present biliary cancers. And Dr. Rogoff will discuss colorectal cancer. We're also asking our faculty to step out of their comfort zones. Each one of these faculty have amazing expertise in their respective disease types, but we're actually going to be asking our faculty to talk about diseases outside of, say, gastroesophageal cancer, to talk a little bit more about biliary cancer and colorectal cancer, so it'll be a fun discussion today. But with that, I'll hand it off to Dr. Sarah Lenardi to talk about gastroesophageal cancers.
So thank you, Christopher, for introducing me. I'm Sarah Lenardi. I'm happy to be here with you. And I know that you are very tired because we are almost at the end of this amazing ASCO. But I hope that we are able to keep you alive in this hour and a half. So let's go. We are starting with the gastroesophageal cancer, not only because it is first in the anatomy of the GI system, but because you know that we introduced the importance of HER2 amplification and hyperexpression in the gastric cancer before all the other GI cancers. And for sure, HER2 overexpression is the most frequent alteration in gastric and the GI junction cancer. It's esteemed to be, in the literature is 15 to 20, but I would say more like 15 than 20. But it's far the more represented, and especially if we focus on the GI junction, that is largely the part of the stomach that more frequently express HER2 positivity. How this is a big problem, I think, and this is my first really practical message. How we determine an HER2 positivity? Because, you know, at the beginning, it was not so clear that it's so different from breast cancer, because it's different, the kind of tumoral cell. The gastric cell is polarized. We have a lumen part and a basolateral part, like also in the colon. And actually, it's obvious that there is no need to have HER2 receptor on the luminal part because we don't have ligand in the food, actually. And so we needed to know, and our pathologist at the beginning needed to learn that it's not needed to have a complete staining of the membrane to say that we have HER2 positivity. And this is an important point because sometimes, you know, pathologists were used to score breast cancer in 20 years, maybe. And it was not so easy to change the paradigm and to acquire another way to score the HER2 positivity in gastric cancer. You can see here, the names are the same. We say 1+, 2+, 3+, and if we have a 2+, we need to perform ISH to define if it is positive or negative. And so the name of the scoring is the same, but the specificity of the categories has to take into account the different histology of the disease and also the possibility to have only a biopsy and not a surgery sample. And you can see here, and another problem in gastric cancer compared to breast, and also in colon cancer, even if little less, is the tumor heterogeneity. In gastric cancer, we have a lot of heterogeneity, not only about HER2, but also about all the other biomarkers. And you can see here an example of a sample of the same tumor that is completely negative in one part and completely positive in another. So what is the clinical practice message from this? That we need to have at least 6 biopsy samples to have a reliable result. So talk with your pathologist, it's my suggestion, because if you don't have enough tissue, if you don't have enough samples, you know, and also talk with your endoscopist, because If it takes only 6 samples, maybe one is dysplasia, one is normal mucosa, you know, one is underrepresented, and you only have 3 good samples to score HER2. And this is a risk, because due to the heterogeneity, we can miss the positivity. And to miss the positivity is a problem, because in the last 15 years, we used this biomarker to define the best treatment since the TOGA trial in 2010. We know that for the HER2 positive, we have to treat in first line with trastuzumab plus a platinum-based doublet, and obviously only the platinum-based doublet if they are HER2 negative. And for a lot of time, we only had HER2 to define the best first-line strategy for our patient. Eventually, we had another super important biomarker that is not perfect, obviously, but this is what we have up to now, that is PD-L1 scoring. You know, in the last year, we are able to offer immune therapy with a platinum-based doublet in a patient with a tumor positive for PD-L1, whatever the cutoff are you using. And so we are now facing these two situations. And for a long time, we believed that PD-L1 was important only in the HER2 negative, because for years, we used nivolumab plus chemo, or pembrolizumab plus chemo, or tislelizumab. I'm not sure you have in the US tislelizumab, but maybe yes. Only in the HER2 negative. And the gold, the standard for the HER2 positive was only trastuzumab plus platinum-based doublet, with a median overall survival of 16 months. And so we can refer to this number like the benchmark we are comparing to define the next standard. Obviously, it was good when TOGA trial was published, and it was good because it was the best that we have for a long time, but it's not a lot. And so a lot of research has been done, and it was pretty clear from a preclinical research that target therapy against HER2 may be synergistic with PD-1 inhibitors. I won't go into details, but this biological hypothesis was tested before in small phase 2 trial and then in a phase 3 registrational trial, that is the KEYNOTE-811 trial, comparing the standard of treatment, trastuzumab plus platinum-based doublet, with the same plus pembrolizumab. Big phase 3 trial, almost 700 patients. multiple publications. We were able to publish first the response, and actually FDA granted approval, a fast track approval, just after the first publication based on the huge improvement in response rate. And then we presented progression-free survival, and lately, just at the last ESMO with the concomitant publication, the final overall survival analysis. And here, the final data we presented and published, you can see here the progression-free survival with a reduction in the risk of progression of 27% and an improvement in a patient being free of disease progression at 36 months that I believe is clinically relevant. And overall survival was also positive with a reduction of the risk of death of 20%. But I think that the most important thing is that if we select the PD-L1 positive population, that is 85% of the whole population, because it seems that HER2 positive are enriched in PD-L1 positivity. If we select the PD-L1 positive group of this trial, you can see that the outcome is even better, and the data are consistent, whatever you measure, with overall survival, PFS, and overall response rate. And so we learned that PD-L1 matters even within the HER2 positive group, and I think this is the second message I have for you. After refining HER2 assessment, the second thing is to have also PD-L1 assessment within the initial diagnosis. And that's because EMA approved pembrolizumab with the standard of care only for PD-L1 positive with a cutoff of 1. And even FDA, who granted approval based on the first publication, as I said, for all the population regardless PD-L1, eventually, in November 2023, amended the label for this combination, including only PD-L1 positive patient. So, unfortunately, even if we were able to reach overall survival of more than 20 months with pembro plus trastuzumab and chemo, eventually all the patient progressed. We need to admit this sad thing. And in a long time, we knew that second-line chemotherapy is better than doing nothing. This was the first finding. And then, obviously, we found out that the standard treatment for second-line, regardless any molecular alteration, was paclitaxel plus ramucirumab. That is included in all the guidelines as the preferred second-line regimen. And for a lot of time, it was true also for HER2 positive population. Even if we struggled because we tried to do like in breast cancer with a different combination, different line, different way to inhibit the HER2 pathway. But unfortunately, as you can see by the huge number of red X that after the TOGA trial, unfortunately, we didn't have any other positive trial until we understand that we had to overcome those problems that are affecting the possibility to inhibit HER2 across multiple lines of treatment that are tumor heterogeneity, acquired resistant, low expression. And, you know, breast cancer is always first, and so we can advantage of some of the finding they have. And actually, trastuzumab deruxtecan appears to be a possible answer of the problems we were facing in gastric cancer, because actually, trastuzumab deruxtecan, you know, obviously it is an ADC, and so it has obviously a monoclonal antibody targeting HER2, but then we have a linker and we have a payload that basically is chemotherapy, a topoisomerase 1 inhibitor, a derivative of exatecan, deruxtecan, and which are the main characteristics? The thing is that we are not using HER2 to block the biological pathway. Obviously, we do it. But the main activity is due to the internalization of the compound, the linker is cut, and the chemotherapy is released. And this is really a good thing for the problem I presented just before, because obviously we don't care too much if there is a resistance to original trastuzumab, because we are not really trying to block this way. We are releasing chemotherapy. And another big thing is that when the cell undergo apoptosis and disrupt, we have those molecules of the RUX that are going outside the cell, and this is called bystander effect. And so we can act also against the cell without HER2 receptor. This biological idea was firstly assessed in this trial, the DESTINY-Gastric01, mainly Japan, Korea. It was a randomized phase 2 trial of third line and beyond, and so very late line, trastuzumab deruxtecan against standard of care investigator choice. And the trial was largely positive for trastuzumab deruxtecan, a nice response rate of 51%. And you can see here the advantage both in PFS and in overall survival. I find nice this analysis. Coe presented only a couple of years ago at ASCO GI, showing that if the patient received previously immunotherapy compound, they had even better performance with a median overall survival of 16.6 months. And I think it's very interesting because now we are using in 85% of the population immune therapy in first line. And so this is specifically the kind of population we have now, because at that time it was pretty rare to have immune therapy in the previous line. And it was possible in Japan, not in US, not in Europe. But now this is our actual situation. And obviously, this was not enough to register trastuzumab deruxtecan, and so we need to perform a trial in a Western country. And you can see here the DESTINY-Gastric02 was a single-arm trial only to confirm the performance of the drug. And it was confirmed. You can see here also PFS and overall survival, pretty similar to the DESTINY-Gastric03 trial. So, trastuzumab deruxtecan was indicated as the preferred regimen both in the US and European guidelines. But actually, we just saw a couple of days ago, or yesterday, the presentation of the DESTINY-Gastric04. This is a confirmatory trial because we already had the DESTINY-Gastric02 that was a pure second line. But here we have a randomized trial consenting us to really estimate the benefit of trastuzumab deruxtecan and also to understand if its correct placing therapy is the second line or other. And the trial is absolutely positive. You can see here that we have a gain in overall response rate, in duration of response, and also, obviously, the primary endpoint was positive, overall survival with a reduction of the risk of death of 30%. And you can see here the gain in the median. And also, I think that the nicer part of these curves is the late benefit that we have using trastuzumab deruxtecan in second line, despite, obviously, the control arm patient received trastuzumab deruxtecan as a crossover in the later line. So my conclusion is that for now, the positioning of trastuzumab deruxtecan is a second line. We'll see in the future. This is the gastric 03 platform. A lot of court, some of them in first line. Two trials are just been launched in first line, and they are the Destiny Gastric 05 and the Artemide biliary, not biliary, I have both in my institute, sorry, Artemide gastric cancer trial, and they are randomized first line with trastuzumab deruxtecan and immune therapy. So let's see. I would bet that in some years we will talk about trastuzumab deruxtecan in first line. This is not the only novel HER2-directed therapy in gastric cancer. We have a lot of different compounds acting differently. You can see here. And I think that beside, obviously, trastuzumab deruxtecan, the more interesting for now is zanidatamab. Zanidatamab is a bispecific antibody targeting two different epitopes, the same of trastuzumab and the one of pertuzumab. And so it's like we are using trastuzumab and pertuzumab, basically. And another point is that we understood that in gastrointestinal cancer in general, target therapy alone are not working very well. We always need chemotherapy. And that's why zanidatamab was developed since the beginning, I would say, along with a platinum-based doublet. You can see here nice responses, both with CAPOX and FOLFOX, only a couple of patients treated with fluoropyrimidine monotherapy. And this is the progression-free survival of this phase 2 study, very promising, 15 months, and the overall survival. Based on this really encouraging data, a phase 3 trial, only thing to remember is that we need to pay attention to diarrhea if we use zanidatamab. But based on this encouraging result, a phase 3 trial, the Horizon GR01 trial, has been launched with, obviously, standard of treatment that now I think it's not really good because it's a trastuzumab plus chemo without pembrolizumab. And so it's a control arm that will give us for sure something to say in the future. But the experimental arm are zanidatamab plus chemo and zanidatamab chemo and tislelizumab. So if I obviously have to bet, I think that having the KEYNOTE-811 trial, the arm with the tislelizumab is the one we are betting on, but obviously the trial is enrolling and we still don't know. So to conclude, the platinum-based doublet chemotherapy plus trastuzumab and pembro if PD-L1 positive is, for me, the new standard first-line treatment for the majority of the patient. And the trastuzumab deruxtecan is the standard second-line treatment. And we will see in the future what about all the other new compounds that are facing clinical development. And I think that's it.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Lunardi. That is an absolutely wonderful review. And so thank you for not only going through all the data, but also the mechanisms of actions of these drugs, which are unique in their own right. But we've certainly asked our faculty to not only present the data, but put practical uses to it. So Dr. Lunardi has prepared a case as well.
Yes. So I'm presenting a case of a young woman. Once I would have said middle-aged woman, but this year I will have 50. And so she's super young. 51 years old, female, no relevant comorbidities. She started with weight loss and dyspepsia, and so her general practitioner prescribed an endoscopy, revealing a gastric adenocarcinoma, grade 3, MSS, or PMMR, because it was an immunohistochemistry, and HER2-3+. Unfortunately, the CT scan showed, beside the primary tumor, also multiple abdominal nodes, not only local regional, but distant. And so the stage was a stage four since the beginning. At that time, we had the KEYNOTE-811 trial open, and so we enrolled her in November 2019. And she received, you can see in here, let's see if I'm able to use this one. Yes, I'm able. You can see here the large node, retroperitoneal node here. She started the treatment. She received a 6 cycle of pembrolizumab or placebo plus trastuzumab and cisplatin. And then you can see here the nice partial RECIST response with only a small node in this slice of CT scan. And unfortunately, in May 2000, she started with a fever, hypotension, and she was hospitalized in oncology. And you can see here what we found, tachycardia, desaturation, and we performed a RIX, and you can see really a big cardiac shape, and this is the CT scan showing pericarditis. Obviously, we consult our cardiologist. He excluded any other competitive cause of pericarditis, and so we conclude for immune-related pericarditis. And as the guideline says, we started to treat with corticosteroid and ibuprofen and colchicine in prescribed by the cardiologist. So she recovered pretty fast, I would say. And we performed just after another CT scan, and we found a mild increase in the primary tumor and in the nodes. It was not a clear, I would say, RECIST progression, but having this sign of initial progression and also the problem of the pericarditis, obviously, we decided to stop the treatment, and we understood that she was not receiving placebo. Obviously, she was receiving pembrolizumab. And after a while, in July, we decided to perform another CT scan and to decide what to do after.
All right. That's a great case and very real life, including the toxicities. So we're going to take a little bit of a break from the case and actually inquire some questions for our panel here. And so, Dr. Raghav, this is an area of, I guess it has been of significant debate, right? But I think a little bit clearer now as Dr. Lenardi's presentation kind of clarified. But still, you know, given the revised indication regarding the CPS scores, you know, do you currently employ pembrolizumab as a component of the upfront treatment in HER2-positive advanced gastroesophageal cancer only for patients with PD-L1 positive disease? Is there any situation where you would try to utilize immunotherapy in the frontline setting for a patient that was CPS negative?
So it's Sunday night, not a great time for controversies. The answer to the first question is yes. For HER2-positive, PD-L1-positive metastatic gastroesophageal cancer, we would use combination as was shown in the data. The effect size in CPS less than 1 is small. Fortunately, I think that these patients should be moved towards more clinical trials. And as we have seen from the case, immunotherapy is not without its share of side effects. But I'd love to know whether you treat any patient with CPS less than 1.
So I think as you really dive into the data, and this has obviously been a big focus of the FDA and obviously so many wonderful researchers within GE cancers, I think the data with CPS zero pretty, you know, unremarkable, I guess is how I would say. And I think to your point of added toxicity without clinical benefit is what I worry about in that population. Dr. Lenardi, any comment?
Yes, I have to say that we try to offer the combination with pembrolizumab and TOGA regimen to every PD-L1 positive patient, but I would not be confident, even if I could, and I can't, because in Italy we are very strict on the indication, but even if I could, I won't feel confident in treating with pembro a PD-L1 less than 1.
Absolutely. And Dr. Ellis, you know, this is an issue now with this particular patient in this case, but it's this idea of reassessing HER2, regardless of the Z site. And we're going to have a lot of cases. You know, we talk about GE junction and GE cancers. We talk about biliary tract cancers and colorectal cancer. Well, what about reassessing HER2 status after a patient like Dr. Lenardi's patient has already received anti-HER2 therapy? You know, tell us your thoughts about, do we have to re-biopsy? How would you do it? Do we need to do it? Because this provides, obviously, a lot of angst for our providers.
Absolutely. So I do think reassessing biomarker status in general with comprehensive molecular profiling is really important to do at the time of progression to really get to the root of what is the cause of resistance. Certainly, there are some cases where getting additional tissue is challenging or may not be feasible from a safety perspective for a patient. But I think when at all possible, getting repeat biopsies is really important. Now we have the added benefit of having things like liquid biopsies, which, you know, are still a benefit in being able to assess things like amplification in HER2, which is valuable. And particularly in gastroesophageal cancer, we know that one of the mechanisms of resistance to HER2 therapy is loss of HER2 itself. So there have been studies showing up to 60% of patients, that's the mechanism of resistance. Of course, as Dr. Lenardi nicely highlighted, there's so much intra and intratumoral heterogeneity, so it's very complex. But my practice would definitely be to reassess at time of progression.
Great answer. Dr. Lenardi.
Yes, if I can add a comment and a clinical message, I completely agree with you on the need, not, I don't say need, of on the appropriateness of rebiopsy a patient, but we also need to know that it's not always feasible, not only due to clinical problem, but also to logistic problem. You need to have an interventional radiologist or an endoscopist, and then you have to wait for the result. And sometimes gastric cancer cannot leave you 1 month to decide for second line. So my practical consideration is that, obviously, if I add a 2+-ish positive before first line, I want a rebiopsy. If I had a shaky response after first line with trastuzumab, I don't like it too much, and I think it's mandatory to rebiopsy. In cases in which I had a clear 3+ and a nice response to first line, and maybe I stopped the treatment and the patient progressed not on treatment, for instance, probably I don't have a loss of HER2 because I don't have a resistant development. But if you treat with trastuzumab deruxtecan without having confirmation of a new biopsy of HER2 positivity, my advice is to keep your eyes wide open and to check with a CT scan not after 8 weeks, because you have 20 to 30% risk of treating a patient with a loss of HER2 positivity. And so if you treat very closely, you check after 1 month CA19.9, and if it is raising, anticipate the CT scan, or if new symptoms come, anticipate the CT scan. And don't go after 8 weeks for the first evaluation of disease, because maybe you are treating for nothing. And so I would like to go for PACRAM very quickly without waiting the classical 12 weeks for the new CT scan.
All right, Dr. Lenardi, take us through what happened with your patient.
Yes, and actually when we performed another CT scan in July, she had a clear progression at the time, and we saw the first result of the Destiny Gastric 01 trial. And at that time, I had the Destiny Gastric 02 open at my institute, and I rebiopsy because it was mandatory in the trial. She was confirmed as R2-3+, and she started trastuzumab deruxtecan, having a partial response. Actually, she also had, especially at the beginning, you know, I was pretty naive with trastuzumab deruxtecan. She was one of my first patients with this drug. And I have to say that at the beginning, the guideline said that it was moderate emetic risk. And maybe we underestimated, because at the beginning we had a lot of nausea and vomiting, I have to say. And but we quickly understood that we had to start since the first cycle with maximal prophylaxis for nausea and vomiting. So we changed clearly our regimen of prophylaxis. She had a nice, and you can see here the data, but obviously you know. Remember that in gastric cancer we use 6.4 milligram per kilogram. And so, and also we have sometimes the primary tumor, the stomach. And so the incidence of nausea and vomiting is pretty high. And please remember that if we talk about nausea and vomiting, grade 1-2 is also a problem, especially if protracted a long time. Because we always look at the column of grade 3-4, and we say, oh, okay, grade 3-4, it's only 5.8, 2.4, that's okay. But nausea and vomiting for a long time, even if 1 or 2, is really, really heavily impacting the quality of life. And we need to know, we need to use the proper prophylaxis. There was obviously an upgrade in the NCCN recommendation, and so we need to use olanzapine, NK1, 5-HT3, and desamethasone altogether, maximal prophylaxis. And as you can see here, we had a nice partial response with a RECIST reduction of 41%, lasting until October. And then she also maintained the response until March 2021. Then she had a progression. We tried to have an NGS, another clinical message. We don't need in the clinical practice NGS for gastric cancer. Because HER2 is immunohistochemistry, PD-L1 is immunohistochemistry, MMR is immunohistochemistry, Claudin is immunohistochemistry, FGFR2B is immunohistochemistry. So we don't need really a comprehensive genome profiling in our clinical practice, unless we have trials, clearly. At the time, we had some trial, and so we screened with an NGS. We found nothing, as you can see. And so we treated her with PAC-RAM in third line, and then she still had a good performance status. And so we treated with the FOLFIRI-4 8 cycle, that is 4 months, not too bad in fourth line. And eventually we had more or less 2 years of overall survival starting from the first line. That it's not so bad, obviously, it's not enough, and that's why we need to continue to invest in the clinical research for this disease. And thank you. I think this one was the last one.
Yeah, no, it's a wonderful case. And, you know, briefly, Dr. Rogoff, you know, you heard, you saw the data and the results from DESTINY-Gastric04. Where are you prioritizing T-DXd, right, in terms of lines of therapy in patients with progressing HER2-positive gastroesophageal junction cancer?
Yeah, I think consistent with the data in second line.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I'm going to actually throw this to Dr. Lenardi in regards to some of the exciting data you show with zanidatamab, right? And so you show some data regarding the results and the response rates with zanidatamab and chemotherapy. If this regimen were to become available, you know, for what patients would you prioritize its use? And, you know, are you optimistic that the results of HERIZON-GEA-01 are going to be positive?
Well, obviously, the phase 2 data are really promising. And so, and I think that the old original trastuzumab clearly is not enough. And so, obviously, we are hoping that the HERIZON-GEA-01 will be positive. You know, sometimes it happens that you have a striking result in the phase 2 and then you are deluded from the phase 3. And we hope this is not the case, but for now I don't have an answer. We need to see the data.
So, you know, the story is yet to be told. I think it'll be interesting when these results come out, and that if the data are positive, then, you know, how we'll choose between regimens. And I think that hopefully the data, when it comes out, will help guide some of those decisions. So, yeah. Wonderful case and wonderful discussion. Thank you, guys. I'm going to move on to Dr. Ellis to talk about her two directed therapies in biliary tract cancers. Dr. Ellis.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. Really excited to speak with you all this evening about the rapidly evolving landscape of HER2-positive biliary tract cancers. So this is the overview of what I'll discuss today, starting briefly with discussing sort of where we stand currently and what's the prevalence of HER2 across BTC. So our current standard of care for patients with advanced biliary tract cancers is chemotherapy plus immunotherapy. And this has really been sort of an exciting advancement that we've had over our backbone of GemCis since 2009. And this year's the TOPAZ-1 data, looking at gemcitabine cisplatin with or without durvalumab. And the three-year overall survival data was recently published and show that this continued separation of the curves that we see at 3 years persists, and we see a doubling of overall survival. And this sort of pattern is very typical for what we see in many immunotherapy-based studies. Unfortunately, at time of disease progression, in patients with BTC, the outcomes of second-line therapy are really quite poor. You can see here that for our best second-line chemotherapy, FOLFOX, the median overall survival is 6 months, overall response rates of 5%. So there's really a lot of room for improvement for these patients. What's really unique and exciting about biliary tract cancers is that it really is this model for precision oncology, and that many of them harbor targetable genomic alterations. So biomarker testing is absolutely critical. Specifically, you know, you can see very different spectrums and frequencies of alterations across intrahepatic, extrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, and gallbladder cancer. For example, FGFR2 alterations and ADH1 mutations are essentially exclusive to intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma. And now we'll talk a little bit more about HER2 specifically. So HER2 amplification and overexpression is interesting because it spans all BTC subtypes. Certainly, we see it most highly enriched in gallbladder cancer in up to even 35-40% of patients, particularly in Asian populations, though we still do see these alterations even in extrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma in about 10-20% of patients, as well as intrahepatic in sort of single-digit range. And importantly, HER2 positivity is associated with a worse prognosis. So really important to identify these patients so that we can offer them some of these targeted therapies that we'll discuss. So moving on to testing, HER2 testing, in my opinion, should be standard for every patient with locally advanced or metastatic disease across all subtypes, again, recognizing that this is something we see in all subtypes. Ideally, I think this should be done at time of diagnosis. We'll talk about that we actually have a number of first-line trials right now. I'm certainly very envious of Dr. Lunardi in gastroesophageal cancer that there are first-line standard treatments available, and I hope that will be the direction we'll move in BTC. And I think as we sort of discuss some of the response rates we see with some of these HER2 therapies, I think a really exciting future direction to think about is for these patients who are locally advanced, borderline resectable, transplant candidates, how do we integrate these therapies into the neoadjuvant and perioperative space? So in terms of how we test, Dr. Leonard did a very comprehensive job discussing this, but we can look at, you know, both the protein and the DNA level. I'm a big stickler for this distinction between overexpression and amplification, which are used interchangeably many times, but are indeed distinct. So immunohistochemistry is looking at protein overexpression, whereas ISH and NGS is looking at DNA amplification. Again, particularly relevant in biliary tract cancers where tissue is often the issue, having the availability of blood-based NGS testing is really a helpful tool to have. I won't spend time on this since Dr. Lunardi covered this nicely. And at this point, the HER2 IHC-ish testing does follow gastroesophageal cancer guidelines, though perhaps with sort of growing data that BTC is a bit unique, this may change over time. This is a really, really important point. This is actually work done by Dr. Raghav's colleagues at MD Anderson, looking at NGS versus IHC testing in HER2 for biliary tract cancers. And you can see that there's a 15% discordance in HER2 assessment when we're looking at NGS versus IHC. And most importantly, 15% of patients who are negative by NGS for HER2 amplification will be HER2 positive by IHC. These are patients who would benefit from having HER2 targeted therapies. So particularly, again, thinking about those really dismal outcomes we see with second-line biomarker-agnostic chemotherapy, absolutely critical to identify these patients. So shifting now into focusing specifically on some of the data we have in BTC, I just wanted to provide this overview of all the different therapies we have. Again, with FOLFOX at the top, keep those numbers in mind, 5% response rate, 6-month overall survival. You can see that even with some of these earlier combination strategies, we're seeing response rates of more than 50% overall survival in the second line setting of more than 12 months. For BTC, which has a median overall survival with treatment of 1 year, this is transformative for these patients. So again, so critical to identify them. So I won't touch on the mechanism of action, which Dr. Lenardi did, but of course, trastuzumab deruxtecan is our HER2 antibody drug conjugate. The DESTINY-PanTumor02 trial was a basket study, and I'll focus specifically on the BTC cohort. This was looking at patients who had locally advanced, unresectable, or metastatic BTC, who had progressed on at least one line of systemic therapy. This was a global study, so you can see that about half of the patients were from Asia. These are heavily pretreated patients. Median line of prior therapy was 2. You can see that, you know, even 3 lines of prior therapy were seen in 22 patients. And importantly, 17% had prior HER2-directed therapy. And this is one of the few studies we have looking at this HER2-refractory setting. And you can see the data here. Again, this was looking at both IHC2+ and 3+. Didn't specifically look at ISH positivity in this case with this BTC cohort. But you can see in the IHC3+ category, which was about half of the patients, you can see a response rate of 56%. Median progression-free survival of 7 months and overall survival of 12 months. Unfortunately, in this case, in the IHC2+ group, again, how many of these patients were truly HER2 overexpressed? The response rate was 0. But again, I think recognizing sort of the similar phenomenon that we see in gastroesophageal cancer, where there's so much inter and intratumoral heterogeneity, I think it's still really important to consider some of these cases, and we'll sort of shift gears to talking about another trial. The safety profile in many ways is very chemo-like, and that's really important to think about for these BTC patients who are, again, our standard of care first-line therapy is gemcitabine cisplatin, which can be a little bit challenging to give more chemotherapy after that, but nausea, diarrhea, vomiting, cytopenias. And what's really important to be really aggressive and proactive at monitoring is the ILD. So there was, you know, even one fatal case here. And I think we're learning more and more and getting more experience with giving these drugs and feeling comfortable in how to manage these, but an important thing to recognize. So shifting gears to the HERB trial of T-DXd, this was a trial done in Japan, and they also looked at both HER2-positive, which is IHC3+, IHC2+, ISH-positive, as well as HER2-low. And you can see in the HER2-positive group that most of these patients had gallbladder cancer, as would be expected, given that that's the subtype with the highest frequency. 73% had 2 or more prior treatments, heavily pretreated patients. And I wanted to just draw your attention to this HER2-low group, mostly because that will be relevant to the OS data that we see. But you can note that, you know, these patients did have sort of a better performance status, less pretreated, and did have more intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma compared to gallbladder. We know that patients with intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma in general have better outcomes, so important to keep in mind. So here's the data from the HERB study. Again, the HER2-positive group is a mixed population. We know that most of the benefit probably does indeed come in these IHC3+, but again, an overall response rate of 36% of patients. Again, remember, 75% had 2 or more lines of therapy. So to see these response rates is really phenomenal. And even again, in this HER2-low group, 13% response rate. Again, a very mixed heterogeneous group, but great to have this data. And then again, very similar safety profile, of course, with T-DXd. Really important to be aware of the ILD. There were 2 fatal cases here. Again, recognizing that some of this is from years back when these studies are done, and I think we've gotten a lot better at being very proactive with this. Zanidatamab is our exciting new biparatopic, bispecific antibody, which was just FDA-approved in biliary tract cancer in November. And so this is the HERIZON-BTC-01 study. This was the pivotal phase 2b study looking at HER2-amplified patients. These were previously treated patients. Again, the majority were Asian and had gallbladder cancer as well as being IHC 3+. And you can see in this IHC3 plus cohort, response rate of 52%, median duration of response, 15 months, overall survival of 18 months. This is, again, in the second line setting, just absolutely phenomenal to have this kind of therapy. Here's some of the overall survival data, again, showing that in the IHC3 plus cohort, 18 months survival. In the overall cohort with HER2 positivity, 15 months survival. So really fantastic data. And in terms of the safety profile, sort of different from some of the other HER2 therapies, is really it's quite manageable. And Sarah mentioned this, that sort of diarrhea is the main thing we're watching out for. In general, this is very manageable with supportive care. Infusion-related reactions tend to happen early, but with pre-medication, as we do for many infusions, tends to be very manageable as well. Left ventricular dysfunction is a class effect of HER2-targeted therapies, but this is a pretty minimal side effect that we worry about. And I think really important for people that aren't familiar with sort of giving these kind of therapies is that when people hear bispecific, they get very nervous thinking about things like cytokine release syndrome. And this is actually not a T-cell engager, so has sort of a unique mechanism of action. So we don't see this kind of toxicity with this with zanidatamab. Here's looking at some of the ongoing phase 3 studies that we have in the treatment-naive setting. And this is what I'm really excited about, again, because we know that, you know, across cancers, GI cancers, lung cancers, when you have oncogene-driven malignancies, moving these kind of targeted therapies up to the first-line setting, I think, is where the field needs to be going. And so both with the DESTINY-BTC-01, which is looking at trastuzumab deruxtecan with or without rilvegostomig, which is a PD-1 TIGIT bispecific, versus our standard of care. And then the HERIZON-BTC-302, which is the phase 3 study looking at our standard of care, GEM-CIS plus or minus PD immune checkpoint inhibition, again, depending on what part of the world these patients are in, plus zanidatamab. So I think these are really potentially practice-changing studies for BTC. And historically, it's been really challenging to run biomarker-driven studies in BTC. You know, these are rare populations in a rare cancer. But I think with these being global studies, you know, HER2 positivity is enriched in other countries as well as gallbladder cancer. I'm really optimistic about the direction this is going. So that's what I have. So for the take-home messages, again, we see HER2 amplification overexpression across all BTC subtypes from anywhere up to 35%, particularly in gallbladder cancer. Early comprehensive HER2 testing with both NGS and IHC, again, remembering that 15% discordance without including IHC, I think is really critical. Certainly a lot of people think about that, you know, when we have limited tissue in biliary tract cancers, do we want to waste tissue on things like IHC? IHC uses a really minimal amount of tissue. So I think when at all feasible, we should be doing both in all cases. And again, it's fantastic to see this rapidly advancing landscape with drugs like trastuzumab deruxtecan and zanidatamab, which are approved in the IHC 3 plus cohort. We have these first-line trials to consider now. So again, I think testing at time of diagnosis is critical. And of course, the unanswered question about, you know, how do we sequence these therapies now that we have multiple options really should be individualized to the specific patient. We take into account their comorbidities, the mechanism of action of these specific drugs, prior treatments, and the side effect profiles. But great. Wonderful.
So Dr. Ellis, that's a wonderful presentation. Let's take the data out for a spin. So please guide us through your case.
Okay. Fantastic. So the first case I'll discuss is a 57-year-old, very healthy man, presented with pretty nonspecific symptoms initially, with just some vague abdominal discomfort, which then more rapidly progressed to rapid weight loss and jaundice. He had a CT scan that showed a large mass centered in the gallbladder fossa, locally invading the liver and the porta hepatis, as well as multifocal liver metastases. This is a really common thing we see in BTC, where most of these patients present with advanced disease. And he had a liver biopsy that confirmed poorly differentiated adenocarcinoma. IHC profile is often very nonspecific for biliary tract cancers, so it's usually putting the whole picture together with both radiographic findings and pathology to diagnose this gentleman with metastatic unresectable gallbladder adenocarcinoma. So at time of diagnosis, as I have sort of harped on, we did both tissue and plasma-based NGS. and found that this patient had HER2 amplification, and this was also confirmed by IHC with 3+ positivity. And this was also seen in the plasma as well with a copy number of 15. So as standard of care, this patient received gemcitabine, cisplatin, and durvalumab, had stable disease for about 6 months, which is what we see in about 55% of patients, though eventually progressed in the liver. Typical side effects of cytopenias and fatigue. Again, really important to think about, particularly those cytopenias when thinking about second-line therapies. At the time this patient was treated, we actually didn't have any FDA-approved HER2-directed therapies, but we do have an NCCN guideline-recommended treatment, trastuzumab pertuzumab, based on the My Pathway Basket study. And this patient actually got a really tremendous benefit for 10 months on therapy. And this combination is pretty well tolerated with just some diarrhea. Eventually, this patient did progress in the gallbladder and liver, though over this time had the chance for his counts to recover. Unfortunately, he developed a gastric outlet obstruction from this growing gallbladder mass. He had an EGD with a duodenal stent placed. And at this time, he did have a biopsy, and I thought it was really important to retest for his HER2 status, though he did get good benefit from 10 months before. And this confirmed that he had persistence of the HER2 IHC 3+. So considering the mechanism and that we had T-DXd available at that time, this patient was treated with T-DXd, had a really phenomenal response, though eventually progressed in the peritoneum after 11 months, and tolerated, you know, treatment relatively well for being third-line therapy, didn't have any issues that they ran into with ILD or pneumonitis.
All right. So a great example of some sequencing right now of HER2 therapy, which is hard to believe that we're at that point now, right? And even in biliary cancer, that's very, very exciting. Dr. Rogoff, you know, do you typically evaluate HER2 status in all your patients with advanced biliary tract cancers? And, you know, when do you test and what and how do you test? Dr. Ellis had made a great point about the types of testing. So we'd love to hear what you do in your clinical practice.
So, yes, we check for HER2 status in all patients, biliary, gastric, colorectal, and we test them at diagnosis, partly for clinical trials, partly for identifying these patients early so you can move them towards targeted therapy. The testing method is, I think, less critical. We do actually all three. We do blood and tissue NGS and IHC. And there is advantages and disadvantages to each one of them, but actually all of them give you information that help you manage your patients well. So IHC is important because we know that majority of the benefit from T-DXd and other drugs in colon and biliary tract is actually more restricted towards the IHC 3+ population. Yeah. The blood test is because it's a good screening test. It comes back quickly. And the tissue NGS for not just looking at HER2, but also at other biomarkers.
Absolutely. Dr. Ellis, you know, you had a great slide on the HER2 expression, right, in the different parts of the biliary tract. Tell us a little bit more about that. And do you see any difference in efficacy of some of these drugs that you discussed in the different parts of the, you know, where you find the cancer, intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, extrahepatic, and so on?
Yeah, that's a great question. So again, as I sort of mentioned, the HER2 overexpression we see across subtypes, most commonly in the gallbladder and extrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, though we also see it in intrahepatic as well. Sometimes when I see HER2 overexpression, and we have all these debates in tumor boards sometimes about, you know, are these intrahepatic tumors growing towards the hilum or hilar tumors growing towards the liver. And sometimes when I see HER2 overexpression, that sort of pushes me more in one direction versus the other. In terms of efficacy, I think it's, you know, hard to say at this point. Numbers are still pretty small. But certainly I would treat all patients across the board. You know, another thing that we're looking at, of course, too, particularly with doing NGS, as Dr. Rogoff says, is HER2 activating mutations. So, you know, we have one study, the SUMMIT study, that was looking at neratinib for HER2 mutations in biliary tract cancers, which had a pretty minimal response rate of 11%. But I think this is another sort of area of interest. And for these patients that have these alterations, again, remembering that our second-line therapy has such poor outcomes, I think identifying those patients is important. Yep,
absolutely. You know, moving on, Dr. Lenardi, would love to hear your thoughts about this tissue or tumor agnostic indication. for TDXD in HER2 overexpressing solid tumors. Would love to hear what line of therapy, in your experience, you're administering this agent, and would love to hear this idea of low-level HER2 expression, and if you've had any experience using these agents in lower levels of HER2 expression, because certainly we've seen a lot of data with the IHC3+.
Yes. So clearly, I think that we now have data pretty solid on trastuzumab deruxtecan to say that in HER2-positive malignancies, it works. And so I feel pretty confident with the agnostic indication of the drug. I'm less confident on the reproducibility of the activity in the HER2-low across different diseases, because we saw, and obviously Raghav will show us in a few minutes, that in HER2-low colon cancer, not good result. HER2-low gastric cancer, better than nothing, but not so amazing result, I would say. And so I don't feel like we can import the data from breast cancer and say that we can treat HER2-low with trastuzumab deruxtecan in gastrointestinal cancer. I don't know what do my colleagues think about it, but for now, I'm okay with agnostic indication. I'm not okay with agnostic indication in HER2-low.
And Dr. Raghav, in regards to interstitial lung disease, right, and that's come up in the slides as well, what specific strategies are you using to monitor ILD, and what happens if a patient develops grade 1 ILD on trastuzumab deruxtecan?
Yeah, I think the best strategy for monitoring for interstitial lung disease is to be aware of the possibility that this can occur. Do not sort of ignore a mild symptom of shortness of breath or cough that happens once the treatment is started. A lot of these patients would actually have some sort of pneumonitis or ILD kind of a picture on their restaging evaluation, and that's usually considered a grade 1. If that happens, you should definitely interrupt the drug. But there is evolving data that if you manage these early and proactively, then for these low-grade interstitial lung disease cases where there are no clinical symptoms or the severity is mild, there is a possibility of re-challenging at lower doses. And we've done that. And some of the data has shown that that when you compare higher doses to lower doses of these drugs, you can see better interstitial lung disease profile.
Yeah. No, and I love that advice. And again, for grade 1, there's the possibility of that rechallenge. So a really wonderful point. Okay, Dr. Ellis, take us through the rest of your case.
All right. So this is actually moving on to a second case of a very young patient, 45 years old with COPD, who presented with neck pain. Unfortunately, was found to have a C8 pathologic fracture, and on staging scans had a 2.5-centimeter hilar mass as well as innumerable bone and lung metastases. At the time of fixation of this C-spine fracture, she had a biopsy confirming poorly differentiated adeno. And again, putting the whole picture together, this was consistent with a metastatic perihilar cholangio. In the locally advanced setting, sometimes it can be very difficult to get tissue, but in this case, it was less of an issue. But on tissue-based NGS, we did find HER2 IHC3+. This patient got, again, standard of care, first-line gemcitabine, cisplatin, and durvalumab. Had a partial response. Again, this is only seen in about 25% of patients. Did well for 9 months, though not surprisingly ran into cytopenia issues despite many sort of dose and schedule adjustments. And that's really important to think about when we're thinking about, you know, having multiple options available in the second line setting. With zanidatamab now available, this patient was started on study, had a partial response to the bispecific antibody with a duration of response of 10 months and ongoing, with a really dramatic decline in the CA19-9, and really was well tolerated with only some low-grade diarrhea.
Yeah, so a really, really great case, and that brings us to zanidatamab, right? And so I'm going to actually stick with you, Dr. Ellis, if possible. And so just tell us a little bit, and you had both Dr. Lenardi have touched on the mechanism of action. So, you know, tell us what makes this a little bit different. than trastuzumab, and would love, with this recent FDA approval and the outstanding data that you showed, how you're incorporating this agent into your treatment sequencing and algorithm. And I think you showed us a little bit of an example of that, but would just love to hear more.
Yeah, so zanidatamab has a really unique mechanism of action, again, with this biparatopic, bispecific targeting of two different epitopes on the HER2 protein, and also sort of facilitates internalization and degradation, as well as many different immune-mediated mechanisms. So I think maybe even potentially offer something slightly different than just trastuzumab and pertuzumab alone. In terms of how do we sequence these therapies, this is the million-dollar question. Certainly, we don't have any head-to-head data for comparison. I do think, you know, decision-making in terms of sequencing is really important, particularly in considering side effects and comorbidities, even resistance mechanisms. You know, there's emerging data with things like RAS and MAP kinase pathway alterations potentially mediating resistance to some of these therapies. You know, zanidatamab is very non-chemo-like in terms of its side effect profile, whereas T-DXd is more chemo-like. There is data for T-DXd used in the HER2 refractory setting. Again, in the Destiny pan-tumor study, it was only 7 patients, but there actually was one patient who received zanidatamab. So that sort of provides me with some level of confidence, and I think makes sense based on the mechanism of action, which Dr. Lenardi covered so nicely, that I think using that in the refractory setting is a good option to have.
Outstanding. And then Dr. Lenardi, you know, difficult question to ask. We shouldn't do cross-trial comparisons, but yet, you know, here we are. How would you indirectly compare the efficacy that we see with zanidatamab to that with trastuzumab deruxtecan in our patients with HER2-positive biliary tract cancers?
Oh, actually, this is not an easy question. I think that for now we cannot really compare the trial and the data that we have. I'm actually not able to say one is better than another. We don't have head-to-head comparison, and I think it's a bit risky to extrapolate from the data that we have because the number are small and the population might be different. And so for now, I don't have an answer on this.
Yeah, and, you know, love the at least the input and certainly agree. It's really hard to kind of compare, especially across trials. And,
yeah.
You know, Dr. Rogoff, in regards to some of the common toxicities that, you know, practitioners should expect to see with zanidatamab, anything that you have to add there?
Yeah, I think, as pointed out, diarrhea is the key side effect that can limit use of this drug and lead to dose modifications. So as actively as you can manage that, it would be better. And you know, with diarrhea comes dehydration and hyperkalemia and other things. But that's the main side effect. Otherwise, I think the drug is fairly well tolerated.
Wonderful. Outstanding discussion, guys. And thank you. It's exciting to see not only these questions about, you know, it's the sequencing of these anti-HER2 therapies, but it's also wonderful to see the new FDA approvals as well. So wonderful discussion. Thank you, guys. Okay. Last but not least, we're going to end with colorectal cancer. And Dr. Rogoff, please take us away.
All right. Good evening, everyone. I'm sure you're all having a very enjoyable ASCO. I would have never thought that there is a disadvantage to treating colorectal cancer compared to gastric and biliary tract cancers till today. When, because you treat colorectal cancer, you come down last on a Sunday night to give a lecture. But anyways, I'll try to keep you on time and get out of here as soon as possible. And hopefully this will be a very insightful 10 minutes. So, you know, to paraphrase a famous saying, physicians treat patients with drugs that they know little of, in diseases that they know even less, in patients who they know nothing. And this is sort of like the story of precision medicine, and it's not unique to HER2. But what we've done is, over a period of time, as we've treated HER2-positive colorectal cancer, we've learned more and more about the disease and the drugs. I'm really thankful to Sarah and Haley to setting things up, so I don't need to tell you about the mechanism of action and the toxicities. I'm going to concentrate on the efficacy data and the value of these therapies in metastatic colorectal cancer. So we're going to start first with HER2-positive colorectal cancer. HER2-positive colorectal cancer is a very rare but distinct subset of CRC. In an unselected population, it is seen in only about 2 to 4% of all colorectal cancers. But when you see that distribution across the larger scheme of molecular alterations within colorectal cancer, you'll see that majority of those HER2 overexpressed or amplified patients are seen in this yellow box, which is the RAS BRAF wild type patients. There are some colorectal cancers that express HER2 and are RAS mutated, and these form a distinct subset. So out of all HER2 amplified colorectal cancer, about 20% are RAS mutants and 80% are RAS wild types. And this has implications in treatment. These tumors are not only enriched in RAS BRAF wild type, they also have this classic phenotype in which they have increased incidence of brain metastases as well as lung metastases. So normally, colorectal cancer is not the kind of tumor you think would go to the brain. And the incidence of colorectal cancer going to brain is about 4%. But in HER2-amplified colorectal cancer, it's about 18%. So that's the amount of difference it is. So much so that at least in our clinical practice, when we nowadays see HER2-positive colorectal cancer, we usually do get a baseline CNS scan for evaluation. So how do we treat colorectal cancer? And whenever we treat colorectal cancer, the two themes that come up is the colorectal cancer that is HER2-positive RAS BRAF wild type, or is it RAS mutant? And the reason why this is happening is, as you can imagine, in colorectal cancer, EGFR treatment is not given in patients which are RAS mutant. And the reason for that is there is downstream activation of the MAP kinase pathway. The HER2 and EGFR, which is actually HER1, use the similar pathways for activation, and therefore, in presence of a RAS mutation, drugs that would suppress the activity of HER2 are not going to be effective, just like anti-EGFR drugs are not. So our first experience with this has been the trastuzumab tucatinib study. It wasn't the first trial looking at dual anti-HER2 inhibition, as we call it. The first trial was actually done in Europe. It was called Heracles. It used trastuzumab and lapatinib, followed by My Pathway, which was a big basket study, which used trastuzumab and pertuzumab. And My Pathway allowed both KRAS mutant as well as RAS wild type patients coming in, and it was the trial that showed us definitively that these dual anti-HER2 inhibition doesn't work in RAS mutant HER2 overexpressed patients, only in RAS wild type. So all the trials that I'm going to show you for dual anti-HER2 inhibition are going to use RAS wild type population. So this was a 117 patient trial. HER2 was tested according to local testing, and it was non-comparative randomization. The randomization was to single agent tucatinib, so pay attention to that small arm. But otherwise, about 86 patients got trastuzumab and tucatinib in third or fourth line of treatment. So these are treatment refractory patients, and the current standard of care, as you all know, are suboptimal. And you can see that in the overall cohort, the response rate was about 37%. But more critically, if you look at the duration of response, it was actually pretty long. And then the disease control rate was about 71%. Even in this early study, we started seeing some patterns that emerged with regards to who are the patients who are responding. And when you look at the IHC 3+ versus IHC 2+ and ISH population, you see a dramatic difference in response rates. With IHC 3+, the response rates reach as high as 50%. But in IHC 2+ and ISH positive, it's about 20%. And the reason for this is that the immunohistochemistry of the protein expression in colorectal cancer is tightly correlates with the level of HER2 amplification that you have. Furthermore, just like the EGFR story, it seems like when you have a HER2 amplification in left-sided tumors, you tend to benefit more. This is the final analysis of a Mountaineer study, which showed that the response rate stayed constant. In the entire cohort, it was about 39%. The duration of response was 15 months. So when patients respond to this treatment, they respond for a long period of time. You can see those impressive spider plots. The median PFS was about 8.1 months, and the OS was nearly 2 years in a treatment refractory population. When you look at the side effect profile of this drug, you can see majority of these are grade 2 or 1 side effects. The orange represents grade 3, and you can see that that's virtually negligible, with diarrhea being the main side effect. Another elegant analysis that was done in this study was they actually looked at how we assessed HER2, and this was a question that was asked. So they did tissue NGS, blood NGS, and tissue IHC and ISH. And when you look at actually the response rate, it really didn't matter. Almost invariably, the response rate was about 40 to 50%. And this is a theme that you will see for other tumor types, is even though there is discordance in testing, most of that discordance tends to lie at levels of amplification that tend to be lower, protein expression that tends to be heterogeneous, and these are also the patients that don't actually respond very well to our drugs. So that testing difference or discordance may not make a whole lot of difference in how the patients are deriving that benefit. So most important lesson is test no matter what modality you have available. The next study is SWOG-1613. This was trastuzumab and pertuzumab. This is, again, dual anti-HER2 therapy, so only in RAS, BRAF, wild-type population. This was a study that was designed to look at whether dual anti-HER2 therapy is better than anti-EGFR therapy in second line. And anti-EGFR, as you can imagine, is a standard of care for all RAS wild-type patients. However, there is data that HER2 is a resistance mechanism to anti-EGFR because it forms a bypass activation for those pathways. And the study was small. It did not reach its accrual, and therefore it is underpowered to look at its primary endpoint. But what's interesting in this study is when you look at the level of HER2 amplification and you divide this as HER2 low amplified versus high amplified, and that's represented by HER2 CEP ratio of greater than 5 and gene copy numbers of greater than 20, you notice that all of a sudden your PFS and objective response rate flip. So when you look at your median PFS for patients that are really HER2 high, the maximum benefit is from TP. And when you look at the low ones, there is more benefit to Cetiri compared to TP. This is a great insight into understanding how HER2 addicted tumors behave. And it seems like, unlike mutations, which are binary, amplifications tend to be a more spectrum-oriented biomarker, where on one end you have these really high HER2 amplifications that will respond amazingly well to dual anti-HER2 therapy and will derive no benefit from anti-EGFR. On the other hand, you have these tumors that have really low level of HER2 amplification. That's where the current dual anti-HER2 therapy doesn't work. These are areas of unmet need and should be evaluated further. Then we went on, as has happened in breast and gastric cancer and biliary tract cancer, to the next strategy, which is to bring in a HER2 antibody drug conjugate. This is trastuzumab deruxtecan. You're all aware of the mechanism of action and the side effects. And the DESTINY-CRC01 study, because of our experience with RAS wild-type tumors, was only designed for RAS wild-type tumors, although this strategy is more targeted cytotoxic rather than inhibiting the pathway per se. And they looked at a HER2 positive, which is 3+ or 2+ ish positive, and then 2+, which is, and 1+ IHC without ish positive, so not amplified. And these are the HER2 low tumors, the blue and the gray bars. There were no responses in cohort B and C, which is quite clear that the activity of trastuzumab deruxtecan in that population is negligible. And in the cohort A, which is the traditional HER2 positive, we found a response rate of 45% in a highly treatment refractory population. The other key was that some of these patients were already pre-treated with either HER2 or dual anti-HER2 therapy, and you can see that the response rate in that group doesn't really change. It's 43% versus 45.9%. So this is good indication of the fact that this drug is going to work despite prior treatment with anti-HER2 therapy. We also found that when you look at HER2 IHC levels, there is a dramatic difference in that response rate. So when you are HER2 3+, your response rate was 57% compared to 7% for 2+ and ISH positive patients. So this is one of the key lessons from this study. Another thing that we did was we designed CRC-02 study, and the purpose of this study was twofold. Number one, to investigate whether the ADC can actually help KRAS mutant but HER2 positive patient, because there is a small proportion of patients. And remember that this is not a signal inhibition drug. So RAS mutant patients were allowed on this drug. And the other thing was that 6.4 was compared to 5.4, because the toxicity profile of 5.4 seems better in breast cancer. And therefore, the question was, do you lose any efficacy in colorectal cancer? So when you look at the response rates, it was about 37% compared to about 27.5% for 6.4 milligram dose. But overall, when you look at the side effect profile and the efficacy profile, 5.4 milligrams turned out to be the winner here. And therefore, it is now approved in HER2 3+ CRC, irrespective of RAS mutant status, trastuzumab deruxtecan. We also found that, again, as consistent with CRC-01, prior HER2 therapy didn't matter. If these patients had them, they still had response and derived benefit from the drug. The HER2 3+ patients were the ones that received a lot of benefit, with response rates reaching around 50%. And the RAS mutant cohort and RAS wild type cohort both had responses with about 40% and 30% response rate, respectively. So now coming to the last player currently available clinically is zanidatamab. This is a bispecific HER2 antibody. This is the basket trial, and you can see a lot of responses across multiple tumor types, but I've just charted out that colorectal cohort, which is 24. And in these cohorts, you can see that the response rate was actually 38% for single-agent zanidatamab. And it was across 3+ and 2+, but mostly, if you see this, you'll again see the same story arising, that most of the patients are 3+. Zanidatamab is actually being evaluated in first-line with combination of chemotherapy, very much similar to the strategy that has been taken for BRAF. So this is a small study of about 13 patients, where patients who were treatment naive got Bev plus zanidatamab plus modified FOLFOX6. It's a phase 2 study in HER2 positive colorectal cancer, with a confirmed objective response rate reaching close to 85%. And this is tremendous, although it is still a very small study. The median duration of response for the overall population was actually not reached. So not only those responses are good, they actually last for a long period of time. So there are lots of HER2 targeting strategies, and therefore identifying these patients, testing these patients, referring these patients to clinical trial is the key here. And concluding, key takeaways from this is HER2 expression is seen in about 2 to 3% of all colorectal cancers, is enriched in RAS wild-type tumors. Dual HER2 inhibition, not mono HER2 inhibition, works in RAS, BRAF, wild-type HER2-positive tumors. HER2 ADCs show promising activity, along with activity in patients who are RAS mutant, as well as those that are prior treated with HER2. HER2 testing should be performed early in colorectal cancer via either IHC or ISH or NGS or tissue or blood, whatever is your favorite. And as long as possible, please try to refer these patients early for clinical trials. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Dr. Rogoff, I think in the interest of time, we're going to move up actually onto your second case. So just briefly take us through the 71-year-old female, and then we'll get to our discussion questions.
Great. So, you know, this case is going to highlight to you the impact get testing for HER2 and identifying HER2 can make in the life of patients. So this is a patient, 71 years old, hadn't had a screening colonoscopy, presented with bleeding per rectum. Colonoscopy showed a circumferential rectal mass, left-sided tumor. Scan showed multiple liver and bilateral lung metastases, and biopsy showed a poorly differentiated adenocarcinoma. This is the molecular profile. It's MSI stable, RAS BRAF wild type. Of course, it's HER2 positive since this is HER2 positive lecture. IHC was 3 plus in 90% of cells, so it's extremely positive for 3 plus. And the FISH showed this gene copy number that was like 9.5 and HER2 copy number 4.3. Remember in SWOG 16-13, our cutoffs were 5 and 20 respectively for CEP ratio and GCN. Was treated with Bev FOLFOX for 7 months, had a small response and then subsequently progressed, and then was treated with HER2 treatment thereafter. And here's what happened. 7 months first-line treatment. Second-line treatment with trastuzumab plus tucatinib for 11 months with response. These are some of the PET scans that you can see. Liquid biopsy was done at the end after progression, which showed persistent HER2 amplification. And therefore, on third line, patient was treated with trastuzumab deruxtecan for 12 months with disease response. And those are great responses, at least from the trastuzumab deruxtecan. One of the reasons why this patient may not have responded as well to trastuzumab and tucatinib was just because of the lower copy numbers despite the high HER2 IHC. And this patient is still currently on treatment. So as of today, the patient's median overall survival is, or actually overall survival is upwards of 30 months and continuing to respond with very minimal disease. Up there.
Fantastic case and a really great example of sequencing as well. So Dr. Lunardi, you know, we've asked this question for a couple of different diseases and a couple of different drugs. When you look at the global efficacy of tucatinib trastuzumab and trastuzumab deruxtecan, any thoughts about the comparison and even toxicity of those regimens?
Well, I think that for now, they, along with zanidatamab, are for sure the most promising HER2-directed therapies. I'm not able to compare, but I would bet on the need to anticipate in first line. And so now there is the MONTANEER-03 trial ongoing with tucatinib, trastuzumab, and chemotherapy. And I think that in the next year, we are going to use HER2-directed therapies probably with chemotherapy in first line. I think for tucatinib and trastuzumab, this might be very promising.
Agreed. And I think we're seeing that story, right, in colorectal cancer of chemotherapy plus the right targeted agents really making a big difference. Dr. Ellis, as a hepatobiliary expert, going to ask you a colorectal cancer question. You see this, you talked about sequencing, even in biliary tract cancers, now with the approval of zanidatamab and trastuzumab deruxtecan. What about, you know, the sequencing, right, of administering HER2 therapy in colorectal cancer, seeing the data that Dr. Rogoff expertly, you know, presented? How would you kind of think about sequencing these regimens?
Yeah, again, I think sort of the similar principle of thinking about, you know, the patient sitting in front of you and sort of both the side effect profile. And then I think, you know, as Dr. Raghav's case nicely highlighted, is sort of repeating this NGS along the way to really understand, particularly in colorectal cancer where it's relevant, you know, what exactly is the copy number? So I think that can really help inform the sequencing. But I still think this is a big question that we have across precision oncology and GI cancers.
Absolutely. And Dr. Rogoff, you showed some very interesting data with zanidatamab and colorectal cancer in combination with chemotherapy. Understanding that it is a small study, and we're going to have to wait a bit for an answer. Tell us a little bit about, you know, your interest in this regimen, and you know, if it were accessible, how you might use it.
Yeah, I mean, I think you pointed this out, Chris. Is when you take the right targeted agent and you attach it to chemo, clearly the outcomes are much better than either that targeted treatment or chemo alone. We have seen that in Breakwater. For BRAF, I see no reason why that would be any different from HER2. So I'm not like surprised that when you combine Bev, Zanidatamab, HER2 therapy and chemotherapy, you're getting the kind of responses that you would really like to see in that first line setting. But it's early data. We have to let that data evolve. Fortunately, we have the Mountaineer O3 study, which is actually testing that hypothesis of putting dual anti-HER2 therapy with chemo upfront in first line. And hopefully, we'll have those results soon and looking forward to that.
Great. We've reached the end of our program. I just want to say an incredible thank you to our three outstanding panelists and their presentations. I hope you guys have a wonderful rest of your ASCO meeting. Thank you for spending your evening with us, and I hope you have a wonderful evening. Thanks, everybody.